Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And we look at the things that people don't look at, and we talk about things that people usually don't talk about. And today is a very special day for me because today we have an author, a guest on the show with us, Dr. Irvin Yalom. And Dr. Irvin Yalom is a psychiatrist who is a emeritus professor of psychiatry at Stanford University of Medicine, the author of books on psychotherapy, but he wrote a terrific book called Love's Executioner, which if any of you are fans of the TV program The Treatment, that is baby stuff compared to Dr. Yalom's book called Love's Executioner, which has a lot to do with the transferential relationship, the relationship between clients and therapist. We may talk a little about that, but also Dr. Yalom wrote, I think, one of my very, very favorite books in the world called When Nietzsche Wept, which I've talked about on the air, which I strongly recommend, a beautiful bit of fiction. So, Dr. Yalom, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
That's great. That's great. Let me ask you something about, if you don't mind, just since The Treatment is The Treatment, which is the TV show. Have you seen it?
I have seen it, yes.
Okay. And it's such a big hit, and there's In Treatment, it's called. And it's such a big hit with people because they feel like they're getting a chance to peek in on that relationship between the therapist and the client, and they're seeing the two sides of it, the dynamics of it. Now, although I think it's presented in a very dramatic kind of way, could you speak a little to the nature of the transference, the erotic transference, or the falling in love with your therapist?
Well, I think that show is quite well done. I loved the first week of it. By the second week, I had more reservations because I felt that he was a lot of flaws were beginning to come up in his work, and the patients were so melodramatic that no therapist had ever seen a week of patients like that.
Yeah, I was curious about that myself. I said, I wonder where I've ever seen this happen, you know, with the...
Right, no, never. People committing, taking overdose in their bathroom, things like that. Furthermore, they have a lot more access to his office and wandering around the office and making coffee. That just doesn't occur in therapy. So it got to be a little unrealistic. The therapist got to be a little bit too flawed. But nonetheless, it's closer to the real thing than almost anything else I've seen. I also liked very much, after the first couple of weeks, which were not good, I liked very much his meetings with his therapist or supervisor. I think that's beautifully done. So all in all, I like this program very much. There are very few shows I've ever seen which even come close to depicting therapy as it may really be. You know, Good Will Hunting, perhaps the movie with Robin Williams, is as close to it as it gets. If I had to see a therapist, that's the one I would see on the mass media. The one in The Sopranos was awful, I thought.
Yeah, that was a terrible...
Yeah, because everything from beginning to end was so tremendously inauthentic. There were so many things they couldn't talk about. The therapist obviously had so much countertrend, so many feelings to what this person was doing, and she had to remain ignorant of so much. When there's big elephants in the room, things you can't talk about, therapy isn't genuine or authentic.
Well, you know, that speaks to the issue of transference and countertransference. You want to give us a definition of what that is?
Well, transference mainly means that the patient has strong feelings to the therapist that seem to be, in Freud's view, seem to be displaced from other sources. People come in to see me because I'm a well-known writer. They imbue me with a lot of wisdom. I get a lot of transference when people first come into my office. They're intimidated by me. They're frightened. They so much want my positive judgment. They see me as a very large figure out there. So I'm swamped with transference with a lot of my people when I first see them. And when you do that, you have got to pay attention to what we call the frame, the relationship between the patient and therapist right away. So I try to take a look at what my writings have meant to them, whether they've read them or not, what it's like to see so much of me out in print, to see my so much self revealed about myself. So I try to get that kind of out of the way. So transference. Freud used the word transference, meaning that the material from early transference, early patients, early figures in life, their parents, are transferred onto the therapist.
So it would be, therefore, that somebody coming to see you as a famous author, they would say, my transference to you is going to be not to you, the author, but to you, the savior daddy, who I'm looking for. Is that what you're saying?
That's one. It may be to the wise man archetype, the person who really knows so much and may be my savior. You know, I get to be a vessel into which people pour all their fantasies into me just because I'm a fairly good writer. So that's another kind of transference.
So then how does the erotic transference come out of that? How does the romantic transference emerge out of that situation?
Well, the patient idealizes the therapist a great deal. In love relationships, generally, the infatuated love relationships consist of a certain ideal.
I'm losing your voice a little.
In love relationships, in general, the one person idealizes the other. By that, I mean that they see only the perfect parts of the other, and they are fascinated with every movement of the other, and they blur over any negative things. And in therapy, that is very well done, too, because for one thing, the patients know so little about the human parts of the therapist and what they see every day in living with the person. The therapist is smoothed over and gets to be very idealized. And any feelings that they've had about a father or a person loving them, a person adoring them and cherishing them as mothers and fathers once did, gets to be put onto the therapist.
Now that's could be part of the treatment. I remember in my own training and supervision, that was covered as something that would be expected, and then the therapist would handle that in a certain way. How does a therapist handle that besides running to his therapist?
Well, the therapist begins to take a look at that, begins to help the patient see him or her as a real person, finds out some kind of a history of how that person may do that with others. In a more Freudian point of view, an analysis, you use that kind of transference to the therapist to get information about the way that person related to early figures in their life. You see, in the way that I like to do therapy, I get information about figures in early life in order to find out more about my relationship with patients.
Oh, that's like a reversal.
It's just the opposite.
Sure.
You see, it's in order that we can have a more genuine, authentic relationship. I consider the relationship I have with patients as prototypic of the relationships they can begin to form with other people so that they can begin to take risks with other people and feel at home, disclosing a great deal more of themselves to intimate relationship, of course not indiscriminately. So I tend to have a much more open, genuine relationships. I tend to reveal more of myself. And a lot of that flows from a particular point of view I have about therapy, which I think of labeling perhaps an existential point of view, and it's got to do with my new book, Staring at the Sun, which is that you tend to see yourself and the patient as fellow travelers. You're both facing the same situation, the same threat of mortality. Each of you are going through this life cycle. Each of you want to persist to be in their own being. And each of you have to face death. That increases the sense of compassion. And it also decreases the idea, the medical model idea, that you, this immaculate healer, are you still there?
I'm here. Yeah.
you, the Immaculate Healer, are facing some patient with a kind of exotic rare disease. You see, I don't work that way. I think, well, we're all facing these things together, and I'm much more willing to look at these parts of myself and answer patients the questions that patients answer to me.
So in your work, when you're working with someone and you see a transferential relationship, part of the way that you bring it down to reality is, I mean, you're saying, if I could show the patient that they could have a relationship with someone like me without crossing boundaries that are considered intimate boundaries, but we could have a true close relationship with, and that we could dispel some of those fantasies and images of who I am,
sure,
that's going to help the person have maybe their first healthy relationship.
That is certainly my hope and my intention.
But then why wouldn't they want to marry you?
Well, then you make that very clear. Look, we can talk about, we can do anything, say anything we want to, as long as we stay here in our chairs. There's to be no physical contact, no sexual contact, as this therapist is trying to do. If the patient is constantly being flirtatious with him, well, it also means she's not being other things with him. She's only showing one part. She's showing kind of courtship behavior. And you really have to just work on that very hard.
And if, that may camouflage other parts that we're not seeing because she's so used to doing that.
If she's showing courtship behaviors, it means that she may want to conceal other parts of herself. And the same thing happens with male patients and female therapists also. And it also may be, if the therapist falls prey to this, then he is sort of in some covert way, as I think the person in treatment was doing, almost encourage and collude in this transferential material.
Well, so, now that's an interesting question, because one of the things I always had in question in my earlier years was what they called the counter-transferential reaction. It always seemed like a way of blaming the patients, because in what you're saying, in effect, is sometimes the therapist sees the patient as their savior. Because a patient can walk in, and if it's a beautiful person falling in love with a therapist who's feeling old and worn out,
yes,
right, then that's transference. The transference from the therapist to the patient.
Yes, and we call that counter-transference.
Well, no, I thought we call counter-transference that which is the result of reacting to exactly what the patient puts on you. See, so there's a difference. I think the difference here is that sometimes the therapist is the one who's acting it, you know, who's in charge here, because they see somebody who may be beyond them.
Yeah, well, that's why it's so dreadfully important, terribly important, for the therapist to have a prolonged therapy of his or her own. I can't emphasize that enough with my students. I know that they go into I just had a call from one a few minutes ago, goes into a clinical psychology program, and they are required, you know, to have 16 hours of therapy. Well, you know, that's nice, but it's really a drop in the bucket here. And it may be they're going through the motions of getting the required hours, but I think, you know, that a really good therapist spends just countless hours in personal therapy. And furthermore, I push it even further. I think that a therapist should go into therapy at several times in the life cycle, because things will come up that don't come up in earlier treatment. I'll give you a personal example. When I started my psychiatric residency, I was at Johns Hopkins. Well, I started off with a personal analysis with a training analyst in the Baltimore Institute, and we had four or five times a week for 3 hours. Well, that adds up to about 700 hours. So that was my first psychoanalysis. And then, later on, well, I was on the faculty at Stanford, and I started to do something else. I started to work with patients who were dying of cancer. And for several years, I worked with patients like that. I was in the process of wanting to learn a lot more about people facing death and existential issues. But I began to developed so much anxiety about this, so much death anxiety of my own, and realized that I had never even talked about this in my previous analysis. So I got myself back into therapy, this time with the analyst, Rollo May, who would know a little bit more about this. And then there are other things. In fact, if I'm feeling discomfort or anxious or insomniac or whatever, I like to make a point of going to see a therapist of a totally different persuasion. So learn more about that approach. I've seen a Gestalt therapist and a behavioral therapist, even for that very reason, to see what they have to offer and other things that I could incorporate into my own therapy with patients.
So it's not only getting them, it's also getting yourself to have a place that you could talk in some depth about anything that might touch you, because there's stuff that you wouldn't share with a patient because you don't need to share it with them,
that's
including
right.
what's being triggered in you
that's
by
right.
anything that's going on. If somebody talks about violence and it triggers something in you or some attitude or prejudice you have about violence, you may not want to share that attitude directly with the patient.
But you need to be totally aware of it, and you need to be totally aware of the way that you're responding to that patient.
And in order to have that awareness, you need some kind of a mirror. And sometimes it's so easy for someone in the profession to lose the mirror.
That's right. So professional friends, professional colleagues are tremendously important with whom you talk about. Luncheons are often talked about with people talking about their difficult issues with certain patients. I've been in a support group of other psychiatrists for over 15 years. We meet once every other week for a couple hours, hour and a half, hour and 40 minutes. And we, this is the same group of people meeting all these years. And one of the things about it that never ceases to amaze me is I think I know all these people, and then every week new layers keep unfolding and unraveling, and I see different aspects of these people. That's a wonderful...
What a beautiful thing.
For therapists, this is... I'm always preaching this. It's so simple for therapists to get such a group forming. You don't have to pay a leader because there's so much expertise in the group, and get together 8, 9, 10 of your colleagues and meet every other week to work on not only your patients that are difficult, but, of course, then yourself and the ways in which you're responding to these patients.
I remember in my quite a few years ago, I was touched by my first case of multiple personality disorder. And here I was in a lost world. I had no idea what I was doing.
Sure.
And here the same person appeared in three different forms in my office.
Yeah.
And I went running to somebody who wrote a book called Minds in Many Pieces.
Yes.
And I remember just running, and suddenly it opened up all the different doors of my mind to things about myself.
Right.
Which was a great opportunity.
Yes, it's one of the great things about being a psychotherapist.
That's true.
One of the great benefits of it is that it seems a burden, but it's also a great benefit, is that you're continuously working on yourself to the very end of your career. Maybe another benefit of it is that we get better as we get older because we get wiser. You know, we learn more about ourselves and more about people. A lot of specialties that are in the helping professions, let's say surgeons and others, you know, don't get better as they get older because they may lose some dexterity, manual dexterity, but also because the technologies are moving so fast. Whereas I think in psychotherapy, there's an accumulated wisdom that begins to accrue.
We're speaking with Dr. Irvin D. Yalom, Y-A-L-O-M, author of the book Staring at the Sun and my other most favorite book, When Nietzsche Wept.
Incidentally, there's a DVD of a movie of When Nietzsche Wept now available on, your rental places, Blockbusters, Netflix.
No.
Yeah.
No.
It came out about 3-4 months ago. It's gone right to DVD.
And who's in it?
And, it's got an amazing performance, one of the best single performances I've ever seen by Armand Asante.
Of all people.
Of all people. He is playing Nietzsche, and he's playing Nietzsche better than Nietzsche could have played him.
That's fantastic.
And the other major figure in the movie is Joseph Breuer, and that is played by Ben Cross, the man who was in the lead of Chariots of Fire a few years ago.
Well, what a nice thing. Since it's my favorite book, and one of my favorite books, and my name is Armand, I think we have to go look this one up.
Hey, that's great.
How about that? Hey, so listen, you were talking about as we get older and we get a little wiser. You know, if you were to think back and flip all the way back to you at the age of 28 or 35 years old doing your work, which may have been when you first published your book. Is that true? About what age?
Well, let's see, the first book I published was a textbook on group psychotherapy.
And how old were you at the time?
1970. Well, I was already about getting close to 40.
Okay, so around that time, there's a difference. Are you still there?
Yeah.
It's a loose wire, I think. Are you there? Nope. Okay, now here we found out something. We found out with Dr. Yalom that if his phone goes dead, which it might do, and are you there? In Palo Alto, very much, he's going to walk over to another location where I'll call him in a little bit. This is Armand with you with the Positive Mind. So this interruption which we have, we will, what will we do? We will find a... Oops, no, we don't want that. Find a way to reestablish this call. No, we're not going to do that. You know what I'll do for you? I'll play you a little music. And when I come back, my friends, I will come back with Dr. Yalom. This will take about 3 minutes, but actually, you know, let me tell you one more place while I'm talking to him. I want you to know that I'm a little awestruck. Because he's such a beautiful writer and such an insightful man. He wrote this book called When Nietzsche Wept. Now, he said it's available on a DVD, which is fabulous. When Nietzsche Wept is a story about when Nietzsche, the great philosopher from Germany, a woman goes from Nietzsche and she goes to Dr. Breuer. Now, Breuer was Freud's predecessor. Freud had a, they discovered together this thing called the talking cure. And what the talking cure was about, it was about, hey, if we just talk to people, sometimes they get better. And they would primarily deal with people who had what was called hysterical, syndrome, or it would mean that some part of their body went awhack, but it was psychologically based. So what would happen was they would find that by talking to people, and just by talking to people, they got better. These were neurologists. Now, the neurologist was Breuer and Freud. They were neurologists. So they said, it's amazing. You just talk to somebody. Let's try talking to somebody else who's got a symptom. And they talked to other people, and they found they got better. So then they learned that talking included uncovering some of the things that are hidden from immediate awareness. So by talking about stuff that's going on inside of you, in your depth, and so on and so forth, they discovered that this process called the talking cure, well, it was in its infancy. Dr. Yalom writes a book about maybe this happened or it probably didn't happen. And the book was about Nietzsche's mistress at the time goes to see Dr. Breuer. And says to Dr. Breuer, you have to cure Nietzsche. Nietzsche is depressed, and he's one of the most important men in the world, and he's going to form the future of Germany, and you must help him. Well, Breuer says, well, I don't know, this talking cure is brand new, but I'm willing to try it out. And she says, well, okay. And he says, bring me Nietzsche, and I'll help Nietzsche. And she says, but Nietzsche's too proud. You can't expect Nietzsche to come to you. So he says, well, then what'll I do? She said, you'll have to go to Nietzsche. He said, okay, I'll go to Nietzsche if it's that important. She said, but you can't tell Nietzsche what you're doing because he'll never tolerate being treated by a doctor. So you have to go to Nietzsche and you have to ask Nietzsche for help in an existential manner, a manner of your own life. And then by you forming a relationship with Nietzsche, Nietzsche can talk to you, and the two of you can then get into the process. Well, this beautiful book goes on with the relationship between Nietzsche and Breuer, where together they're discovering the unconscious mind. It's a beautiful thing. And they're doing it together. I mean, a little scene that I remember, which was at the cemetery, where I think it's Breuer is visiting his mother's grave. And he says something like, there's my mother, and my mother's name is Greta. He said, isn't that a funny thing? My wife's name is Greta. He said, do you think it's just a coincidence? You know, and you see the birth of the psychoanalytic belief and the thought process. So it's quite remarkable to me that Dr. Yalom could put all this together in such a touching way. It reminded me of Narcissus and Goldman, you know, which is such an important volume also. So that's off to the side. Now what we're going to try to do is call Dr. Yalom at his other address, and let's see if this works. It should. 493. In California. And we might have this. Let's see. Let's see. This should be working. As arranged. Hi, is Dr. Yalom there yet? Thank you. Well, I'll be darned. It worked.
Hello?
Hi there, Dr. Yalom.
Sorry, I don't know what happened, but I'm on a landline right now. It's not a cordless, and so I'm sorry about that.
It's wonderful. I had a good chance to talk about the meaning of the book When Nietzsche Wept.
Oh, good.
About that to people, and we're going to go further into Staring into the Sun.
Okay,
now where we were at that moment, I was going to ask you this one question. The young Dr. Yalom, right, knows one thing about the human mind, and the Dr. Yalom now knows something that if only he had known it back then, he would have, it would have made such a significant difference. What would you say that is? Of course there are many things, but is there one big thing?
Well, you know, I went through a couple of different stages in my own professional career.
Oh, I can't hear you now.
I went through a couple of different stages. When I first started working, I became very interested in what we call interpersonal psychotherapy. You know, that we are very interested, not so much, even though I had my first analysis with a Freudian, orthodox Freudian analysis, I wasn't persuaded that the idea that so much of our conflict is caused by suppressed sexuality. Because I felt that there was much more to be looked at in terms of our relationships with people that occur later in our lives, during our growing up and during our adolescence and during our early adulthood. So I was very much of a follower of people who looked at interpersonal relationships between people. And the people who are important in psychiatry in that way, most of them are really Americans, are transplanted Europeans, people like Harry Stack Sullivan, not known to the general public, but known very well to therapists. We know him so well that we don't even know his name because he's one of these people who's become so incorporated into everything we do. Karen Horney and Eric Frohm, these are other people.
And Rollo May.
Rollo came along in a slightly different way, and he came really early in my training. His book came out and really changed my direction. But the first direction I had was interpersonal, and the best way to look at the way people relate or don't relate very well to people is in therapy in groups. I felt that was the ideal arena. If we could get the group to work not on past lives of people, but on how they relate to one another in the immediate here and now, what was happening in the group. So, and we made the assumption that if people were acerbic or arrogant or obsequious or self-effacing in their lives, they were going to do the same thing in the group.
Your voice is just fading a little.
They were going to do the same thing in the group.
Thank you.
In other words, people, the group was a social microcosm. What they did in the group was really a reflection of what they did in real life, and here was a great opportunity for us to approach that. So I began to make the assumption that everyone who came to us fell into despair because they were unable to establish and maintain nurturing, sustaining relationships with other people. Then, as you were mentioning here earlier, Rollo May came into my life when I was in my residency. He wrote a book called Existence, and I began to read that with great interest. And I began to think, well, wait a minute, there's something else that everyone else seems to have forgotten about in a way, which is the fact that we also are faced with a confrontation with issues, right, that are absolute central to our existence. And so at that point I started taking courses in philosophy, and I've done that for the rest of my life, and learning more about what the great thinkers have had to contribute to our field.
And so now, existentialism.
That's right. Now I consider people who fall into despair also may come to see us because they are confronted with some of the conflicts that are absolutely central to our existence. Maybe the primary one might be that we're mortal. We have to face death. And yet, we all want to persist in our own being. And we're all frightened of that. And we don't want to cease to be.
We're going
to
come right back. This is Dr. Irvin Yalom. Dr. Yalom, be sure to stick with us. Maybe get a cup of tea. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to continue with this very, very exciting discussion. Thank you so much. Please bear with us. We'll be right back. And this is Armand DeMille back with Dr. Irvin Yalom. I'm not playing the music yet because it comes with the story. Dr. Yalom, are you still with us?
I'm still here.
Great. Great. And thank you so much for giving us an hour of your time. I mean, I know you probably expected it to be shorter, but this interview is going to be, will last a very long time. We'll wind up posting it on the internet and people from around the world will benefit from this. Let's go back to this issue of what we learn as we get along. So at first you thought, psychoanalysis, learn the beginning, learn the basis, we'll fix people, we'll help them with that. Then we go the Harry Stack Sullivan way, and we say, let's talk about the only way you could get to know yourself is if you know yourself in relationship. Then we go the Rollo May step, and we say, but wait a minute, it's not just you related to another person or to your immediate group, but the group is even bigger, it's your very existence.
Exactly.
And now, as I hear it, you are saying, and not only is it about your existence, but it's about your non-existence. Hence brings this daring, daring piece of work, Staring at the Sun.
Yes, I wrote a textbook. It took me a long time, about 10 years. I called it Existential Psychotherapy.
You know, the phone that you have, by the way.
What?
The phone that you have right now has a kind of fade on it.
Okay, so it's a land phone. I'm very surprised.
It's just that.
I'll be speaking louder.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
The textbook that I wrote called Existential Psychotherapy took me about 10 years, and it's really based on the fact, well, this question. If you really look deep into your own existence, if you, just sort of remove all the everyday distractions and meditate upon yourself and your position in the world, I think you get to certain ultimate questions, ultimate concerns. And there may be many, but I thought there were four that were especially germane to work we do as therapists. One of them, of course, I've already mentioned, is death. There are others. There's the idea of meaning in life. What are we here for? What purpose does our life have? And there are some therapists, for example, Jung, Viktor Frankl, who emphasized that tremendously. You know, I've always thought that we are meaning-seeking creatures. We tend to cluster things into patterns and gestalts, but I think we're meaning-seeking creatures, unfortunate enough to be thrown into a world that is intrinsically without any meaning. And so we have to build a meaning, invent one. That's sturdy enough to hold our own mind.
But do you really think existentially the meaning has any meaning at all, or is the meaning just another one of those artificial constructs?
Well, I think it's an artificial construct. I think it helps us to live our lives, though, and to feel that we are relating, passing something on to others. So, yes, I feel it's artificial. I think that we live in basically a chaotic, a contingent world, and we have to construct our own life and meaning.
How daring of you. Well, then would you also say that about, and I don't mean it as a trap, but I mean it as an absolute question from professional to professional, do you say that about romantic love also, that that's another artificial construct?
Oh, of course it is. Yes. In fact, it's hardly a solid construct because romantic love, and I'm taking as your word romantic, there's all kinds of different love. But I'm talking about romantic, a kind of infatuation, idealized love, where you cannot get the other person out of your mind and you worship every movement they take. That's the kind of love I often talked about in my title story on Love's Executioner. And in fact, I make that point that patients who are in love you know, rarely want to do much work in therapy because they don't want to examine it very closely.
They want to hold on to this image. So as soon as somebody finds a new girlfriend, they're out of therapy.
Well, that's right.
You know, very
often they are. I have somebody I work with now, more than one, as a matter of fact, who want to hold on to this love. They don't want me taking it away, or I'm not trying to take it away. I'm trying to help them examine it and see if it's in their best interest, and because they want magic in their lives. You know, life without that would feel gray. They're in midlife crises. They look ahead of them. They see nothing but decline. But this idea of falling in love and having this glorious feeling. Nietzsche put it very well. Nietzsche said that often we're more in love with the desired, D-I-S-E-R, with the desire. We're more in love with the desire, the state of desire, than the desired.
Falling in love with love itself.
That's right. We're more in love with love itself rather than the person we think we're in love with, because we love the high and the magical feeling of being in love.
So it's more like, I think you're saying, I love me when I am loving you, and therefore I call myself loving you.
That's right.
I
love the me, and I love the feeling that's enveloping me of great magic and exaltation. And it's wonderful to be in love. Everybody should have that experience at one point. But that kind of romantic, infatuated love, also, if it's going to stay in any kind of a permanent fashion, it's got to become more realistic, and you've got to have certain kind of person whom you respect and admire and want to spend your time with.
So if somebody comes to you and they say, I don't know if I should marry the guy or not marry the guy, I don't know if I love him or not, you kind of look at that and you go, oh, here we go, we're going to start from square one.
Well, I was in a conversation with that with a patient not too long ago.
I can't hear you again.
I was in a conversation with a patient around that issue not too long ago, because she had gone from romantic love to romantic love, and I was raising the question of, do you have any kind of criteria for people you want to be with? It almost came as a surprise to her. You know, are there things you would want in a mate, in a husband, things in terms of his intellectual capacities or interests and what he wants to do in life and what he stands for? These weren't questions for her. She was more like what we call nascent oxygen. Oxygen that immediately has to bind with another electron. You know, you can't stay in a single state. There's something about aloneness that's terrifying. Some people fall in love because they cannot stand to be alone, even for a brief period of time.
Now, to deal with that,
they cannot get out of a relationship because they fear being alone. Bad reason to continue a relationship.
So if you go the Irvin Yalom way, what you're going to do is, you're not going to talk about what to do in a relationship and how to choose a partner. You're going to talk about how to face your death so that you're not so afraid of being alone.
Well,
that for a little jump.
let me say something else. When I talk about existential psychotherapy, I'm not saying that there is a special school of this that I do with every patient. What I'm saying is that I think a good psychotherapist should, in addition to all the other useful approaches in therapy, also have a sensibility to existential issues. So if patients need to talk about one areas of their life, I will do that. But I also have a sensibility to these existential issues that arrive. And some therapists don't do this, especially issues that have to do with mortality. Because you don't want to get into that bag of worms, because we really don't know what to do with that anxiety. But that's the reason for the title of my book, you know, that we're not supposed to stare at either the sun or at death. There's an old proverb about that.
What do you do with this? I mean, tell me, I know we're going to tell people to read a book, but how do you work with the awareness of death? How do you bring it into consciousness? How do you examine it? There are people with overt death anxiety, and then there are people who, you can see it's behind everything they do.
Right. Well, it's also behind everything they do, but they are so frightened at it that they can't look very much at it. I'm suggesting that you bring this up as a topic of conversation. A patient who comes to me who took a long drive for a couple of hours. But she came in so sad because she was with her a couple of her relatives, a father, and saying, oh, they're all going to be dust in a little while, and all these beautiful mountains and trees, they're going to be nothing in a little while. And, you know, all of her life was taken away from her by this terrible fear of death. My inclination, I want to start to, I may even ask a question that sounds very stupid. I even say this. I say, look, this is a simple-minded question, but humor me. Let me ask you this question. And then I say, what precisely is it about death that is so terrifying to you? Now, that feels simple-minded, but you would be quite surprised by the vast array of answers you will get to that. And that vast array of answers that you get to that allows you to know where to go in and where the great sources of fear was. One particular patient is what I'm thinking of right now. Her answer to me, you know, was all the things that I haven't done. You know, she was a 40-ish year old lady, and that was her sense. And there's a rough formula between a sense of unlived life, the sense of not filling your potential in life, and the amount of death anxiety. Usually the more you feel you've had an unlived life, the greater is your sense of death anxiety.
But you would say that's illusory also because, you know, I haven't gotten rich, I haven't bought the car, I haven't done the travels. But those are meaningless.
Well, those aren't the kinds of unlived life I'm thinking about.
What are you thinking about?
I'm thinking of something that's somehow more solid. You know, the idea that I've never been able to allow myself to create in the way that I want. I've never allowed myself to be able to love and get close to my children or my spouse in the way that I want. A certain kind of a more fundamental kind.
Mm.
And I think that facing a death quite openly can shock you into living life in a much more authentic way.
And how would you face death openly in psychotherapy without LSD?
I'll give you an example. I think there are certain kinds of awakening experiences in our lives, and I'll move from there to answering your question precisely.
Sure.
I use the example in the book Staring in the Sun. I use this prototypic example in literature of Scrooge. You know, in Dickens' Christmas Carol, Scrooge starts off as this mean-spirited, very selfish, much disliked person who is loved by no one. And Dickens decides to give him some existential shock therapy of the toughest kind. He sends the angel of the future to him. The angel of the future takes him ahead, lets him see his own death, lets him see his own funeral and how nobody comes and nobody cares and people dismiss him lightly, and then lets him feel his letters that are engraven in his tombstone. And the very, very next scene in the Christmas Carol, Scrooge is a transformed person. He lives very, very differently in life. So that's what I mean by an awakening experience. Are you with me?
Yes, I'm with you. Okay.
So, now, in therapy, I first began to have that kind of experience as I worked with people who were facing death. For 10 years, I worked with people who had cancer. I was much surprised and edified by the fact that there are a certain number of people, fairly large proportion.
Volume again.
A third of people who are facing death, that rather than sink into despair, you know, they became enlightened. They began to say, oh, what a shame it was that I had to wait till now to grow wise. So they began to live in a different, more authentic way. So that was their kind of awakening experience. And how do we, in everyday therapy, help people?
Oops. I think our phone just did it again. All right. Well, since we are talking about death, and since I'm going to try to reconnect with Dr. Yalom, which we'll do in just a minute, stay with me, my friends. Here's something quite exquisite. I want to play for you something from Jacques Brel. And it may sound a little depressing, but this is one of the most beautiful pieces I ever heard. Here's Ellie Stone's commentary on death.
nothing much to do. Angel or devil, I don't care, for in front of that door there is you. My death waits among falling leaves, in magician's mysterious.
And that's Ellie Stone, my friends. We have, believe it or not, our phone connection died. Yes, our phone connection to Dr. Irwin Yalom died. I love life. I really do. I mean, we talk about existentialism. You know, here we are talking to Irwin Yalom about the very existence and non-existence of so many things. He's one of the great existentialist. He talks from his book, Staring at the Sun, Overcoming the Terror of Death. Now, death. What a funny thing, death, la mort, the word. You know, the very word scares me. I don't want to talk about death. I don't want to look at a person, dead person. I don't want to go anywhere near that. You know, it's all of that. But the truth is, sometimes you're going to have to face it, and it's an interesting thing to face. Now, I will tell you about early experiences in the 60s. In the early 60s, we had an experience with people where people with 60s, 70s, early 80s, LSD was a big drug, and it was a big drug, and it was being used. Ecstasy was being used. Ketamine was used. A whole bunch of drugs were used in therapy. Actually, during therapy, yes, there were people who were like Timothy Leary was doing therapy with these drugs. And here was the idea. The idea was face your expansive self. And so while these drugs were being used, of course, they got to used and then abused. It got to the point where you not only was it an expansive self, but you were also facing much bigger than that, bigger than the expansive self. Now you were having a good time, too. It was certain sensual feelings that came with it, feelings of ecstasy. But the idea of all the drug therapy and the idea behind the drugs was to get close to the death layer. You wanted to kind of go through that door so that you didn't fear it anymore. Somewhere in the 60s, 70s it was, another doctor, A Dr. Peter Hogan, experimented with a thing called carbon dioxide therapy. And carbon dioxide therapy was simply being... Are we still on air? Is that fine? Okay. Carbon dioxide therapy was you would actually breathe carbon dioxide, and it would send a message to your brain that you were dying. Because if you had that much carbon dioxide, there was something wrong. So you would go there and purposely do this therapy to face this feeling so that you wouldn't feel it. And I went through it myself. And eventually you felt okay, at peace with death. Big deal, at peace with death. Think about how many people we know nowadays when they get near death's door. What happens to them? You know, they get near death's door. We don't tell them you're dying. We don't discuss the death. One of the greatest gifts you could give to somebody who's dying is let's talk about your death. What do you think? What do you feel? What's going on? It's a giant gift, yet no, that's not what we do. Instead, what we do is we tell them, oh, you're not dying, you're going to get better, you're going to be fine. I had a good friend, Richie, who died slowly from leukemia. And the conversation we had about his death was so rich, so beautiful, that when he died peacefully. He wasn't afraid anymore, because he was able to talk about it. So Dr. Irvin Yalom takes his step as he gets older. I believe he must be well into his 80s now. And Dr. Yalom writes his book, Staring at the Sun, which is exactly what he's doing. He's looking at, and he's saying, okay, where are you? Where are you? You want to greet me? You want to come and get me? You want to deal with me? Well, I'm okay, and I'm going to deal with you. And while he does that, in the meantime, he reaches out to us. I want to read you part of his book about overcoming death terror, just one phrase. He talks about the power of empathy. And he said, empathy is the most powerful tool we have in our efforts to truly connect with other people. It is the glue of human connectedness. It permits us to feel at a deep level what someone else is feeling, the universal feeling. Hey, pretty remarkable stuff. So this has been a program that has a little more weight to it than usual. Tomorrow we will continue with you and bring you more stuff. But until we do, let's see if we can keep you feeling a little better about yourself all the time. So maybe, my friends, a gentle smile. Right now, you know, it's a funny thing. You put a smile on your face, and it really does work a little bit. You know, makes you feel better. You want a copy of today's program? You can go to WBAI.org, or you can get it on our website at thepositivemind.com. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. My love to all of you, and my thanks to Dr. Irvin D. Yalom.
You're crying.